week, we take a look at the good life and storytelling. Stories lie at the heart of religious tradition. They provide meaning, promote empathy, and are a path towards truth and understanding. Telling stories is a communal act. It's all about sharing and connecting. Our guest on this week's episode is a modern storyteller. He's the series producer on the ABC television series Compass. Many of you will know the program. It focuses on the spiritual or religious stories of people's lives. Paul Hawker came to the program a little over 2 years ago after a long career as a documentary filmmaker and television producer. He's also written two books about his own spiritual journey, a journey which led him on a quest of biblical proportions to the frostbitten peak of a mountain in New Zealand. Paul joins us to talk about why stories and storytelling have been so integral on his own path through the good life.
My particular interest has always been in spirituality as it's practiced by individuals rather than a religious outworking of it through an organisation. I think it's born out in books I've written, and especially in Compass. Hospital Chaplains, the series that played earlier this year, 8 episodes, was religion and spirituality as it's practiced in hospitals. It was what happens when the rubber hits the road, really. We didn't have official spokespeople on it. We just did stories of what the chaplains encountered, how they dealt with it, the spirituality of the people they dealt with, and how that manifested itself. Some people were dying, were given terminal illness prognosis. Others were just in despair.
Many of the people in Hospital Chaplains weren't people who had dedicated their lives to a spiritual path or a spiritual tradition, but yet they found themselves in this situation where spirituality was suddenly very important to them.
Yes, and there was a very broad definition. Each chaplain had their own definition of spirituality. The intensive care chaplain at Royal North Shore, she said that lifting people's spirits was a spiritual thing to do. And that's why they bring these dogs into the wards, and how she attends to making sure that the family is accommodated well. And just getting rid of all the little lumps in the road, letting them, escorting them through the language of ICU, where people are pretty critical. The spirituality is, it's not expressed with a religious sort of outpouring or prayer or anything like that. It's a very broad definition, which I think comes back to the original thing you were talking about, is that I think we operate very spiritually. It's just not acknowledged. The language of religion's different from the language of spirituality.
Yeah, it can be quite highfalutin, can't it, the language of religion? What's the effect, do you think, of framing spirituality in a more simple, accessible kind of way?
Well, I think that's what people relate to. I mean, Hospital Chaplains is full of stories. Compass is full of stories. You know, I think a great quote is, the shortest distance between a human being and the truth is a story. And I'm a storyteller. I love it. I tell them in television and through writing. I've always found, whether it's a feature film, a drama or a story of any sort, we tell stories, and that's how we communicate, and that's how we communicate spiritually too.
You tell real stories, factual stories. Do you think that that quote can apply equally to non-fiction?
More so, I think. I've just finished tutoring a course at the film school on writing for factual television, and we use the same dramatic arc as does feature films or fiction. You set up a problem, then the characters go through resolving it, and at the end there's transformation, or Hospital Chaplains always ended on a high note. We follow the same path, and that's still retaining the truth. We tell emotional stories. So sometimes I will withhold a bit of information so it has more currency when it's put somewhere else. We all edit. It's never inaccurate, but I will create it so that it has an emotional impact, which we all do when we retell a story.
Yeah. We'll come back to this theme about the significance of storytelling in a bit, but just before we do that, I want to ask, you've been making documentaries and making television for 30 years, is it?
Yeah.
And you've also had a deep and abiding interest in spiritual questions yourself. It seems to me that working on Compass enables you to marry your passion with your craft. How has that been?
Well, it's interesting. Yes, I never thought I would. I've worked in the secular world, Discovery, National Geographic, all the channels in Australia. And there never seemed to be a mix until we did Life's Big Questions. Our executive producer, Rose Hesp, invited me on to series produce that show because she said, that's the sort of thing I've been asking all my life, why don't we do it? And Scott Stevens did an amazing job there. And I was particularly proud of that series. We had Matt Preston, Philip Nitschke, and asking them tough questions like, you know, are you a good man? Have you lived a good life? And seeing profile interviews of the people that they wouldn't have got asked anywhere else. Compass has got the monopoly, I suppose, on that territory. And it's like no one else could do hospital chaplains, you know. And we take that pretty seriously. But that's the first time I've worked in religious broadcasting in my career.
Do you find it any more satisfying or fulfilling than working in non-religious broadcasting?
I don't know. I mean, my favourite program is the one I'm working on at the moment. You know, I'll say that, and I've always said that. But yes, both those series were just right up my alley, and I loved them. And I'm passionate about the quest for meaning, the quest for understanding, for the psychology of what makes us tick. And as we said in the start of Life's Big Questions, is there a God? What is God anyway? And I prefer to find out from people's stories about what they made of it rather than a theological explanation. And one of the highlights of my whole career was Rolf de Heer's interview on spirituality in Life's Big Questions. There's some times where you know you're in the presence of something pretty amazing. We'd been warned that Rolf was a difficult subject, wouldn't interview well, and you could have heard the pin drop in the studio. He went places, as he said to Scott, that neither of them knew they were going to go to, and there was a spirituality in the studio as he was describing awe and describing some events that he'd come across in his career.
This moment that you're describing to me that occurred in this interview sounds something like what you describe in one of your books as a soul affair. Can you explain what you mean by that term?
Yeah, I wrote the book Secret Affairs of the Soul, which is about ordinary people's experiences of the sacred. And there's quite a huge collection of these. Oxford University's been collecting them for decades now.
They're examples
of stories of people. They're asked the question, have you ever been had a sense of a presence or a power different from your everyday self, whether you call it God or not? And there'll usually be about an 80% yes response. And some of these experiences are moments of transcendence, a sense of being guided by an unseen hand, but people really talk about them. And that studio at that time, you just can't describe it. It's and we put it in the interview that went to air. It was something special. I suppose it was truth. There was truth being exchanged without animosity or rancor, and there was an openness around it. And someone said, you don't know what truth is, but you know what it is when you hear it. And that's what we managed to capture.
You say that many people, 80% of people, experience these soul affairs, these moments of transcendence, but yet they're very rarely talked about. Why do you think that is?
There's two things from the research. The two main things are people get subject to ridicule. So there's a sanctity around them people don't want sullied. When people actually talk about them, they'll often weep because it's so profound what happened to them. So there's that sanctity, and also this, you don't think you'll be understood. You know, you'll be dismissed. There's not a language for it outside of religious language. And so you're floundering if you've had something like that, you know, a sense of being guided, like a nurse in Tasmania suddenly took it upon herself to provide humidity cribs to Indian hospital. She knew nothing about it. She just felt compelled to do it. But she couldn't tell us about it until there was a platform, and I was in my interview with her, that she could actually describe it. And the other interesting thing is you don't get it by interviewing people, which is your and my craft. You got these stories by telling another story. You had to tell a story about a moment of being guided by an unseen hand, transcendence or something creepy, before they could share their story. It's a bit like saying, tell me a joke. You can't do it. But if I tell you a joke, you can probably think of three. Something triggers in us. And that was a new experience for me as a story collector.
You'd think that the one group of people that would be able to talk about these sorts of moments would be the clergy. But you say that often it's the clergy who are least able to engage with these types of moments or least willing to engage with them. Why would that be?
It's scary stuff. I mean, it's out of the auspices of the religious frameworks. Often, I think clergy may have had one of these as their call to become clerics, but it's long since forgotten as they got caught up in the bureaucracy of running things. Any religion tends to split into a bureaucratic and a mystical arm, and the bureaucratic normally wins. They've got more time at it and more numbers. So those who are more experiential in their spirituality often can't find a place within standard religious frameworks.
Is it also partly because so much of religion in a Western context is focused on the sort of ethical dimension, how to be a good person, how to live a moral life, and perhaps the experiential stuff is less strongly emphasised?
Yes. There was a book called Exit Interviews by a guy, William Hendricks, I think, in the States, and he exit polled people leaving churches, finding out why they did it. And the comment was, they went to church looking for God but left when they didn't find God there. That doesn't mean that people cannot experience in a religious context these moments. And that's not the be-all and end-all. But if you're after that, you probably won't find it in a religious institution. You'll find other things.
What about you? Have you had your own soul affairs moment, apart from the interview that you described earlier?
Yes, I have. I was a pretty strong seeker of, I suppose in the loosest terms, God, looking for it in religion and people and exploring it as much as I could through reading. I mean, some of my greatest mentors and gurus, I think, is authors. And I had experiences as a youngster. I spent a lot of time bushwalking, alpine trekking. And that's when I had experiences of quite amazing things that myself and my pretty rough mates tucked away and talked about a little bit but didn't give any context. And then in my mid-40s I decided to go back to one of those places and sit there for 6 weeks to see if whatever this God business was about.
Well, that brings us to your other book, Soul Quest. This was a book about a spiritual quest of biblical proportions, really, wasn't it?
Well, it was interesting. One of these mates who I'd had one of these experiences with at 17 when I was a sort of midlife crisis, my oldest two kids had left home, what do I do the rest of my life? And he said, oh, you need to go to a Rhett Bivy and, 40 days and 40 nights, mate, that'll sort it out. So I took him at his word and packed up and did this. It's on a mountain in New Zealand. I'm a Kiwi originally. And took nothing with me except to turn up on day one and see what would happen. I had a spiritual discernment method, but that was about it. And sat and watched and listened and went through the whole epic journey.
Why did you need to do this at this time in your life?
I was sick of not knowing. If there's something to this otherness, then I wanted to test it, I suppose. And now I was at a point where I didn't want to risk my life unnecessarily, but I certainly wanted to be alone in a spot that something would happen.
Yeah. So was this, in some sense, an attempt to hear God's
yes,
voice?
Yes, absolutely. It was a pursuit of, whose voice is it? Are these voices in my head mind? Do I make them up? Is it God? Is it something else? I don't know. That's what I set out to do and to be guided by the inner voice. Look, I'm sure it's got 1,000 different names, but that's what I was calling it because I come from a Judeo-Christian Western culture.
And what happened on the mountain?
It was profound. It changed my life. I just experienced an amazing sense of love and love of life, love of everything, and of being connected. There were profound moments. There were moments of terror. I actually got helicoptered out in the end because I got frostbitten toes. But yes, it was just a sense of, I have no problem with dying. I don't want the sort of transition. It's just peaceful, I suppose. I don't know. It's been a while now, 16 years since I did that. But I don't believe I'd be here talking to you now had I not done that. I think my life and career might have gone in a very different way.
So you got helicoptered off the mountain with frostbitten toes. You came back to your life in Sydney.
Yeah.
What did you bring back with you from the mountain?
I think it's a connection that I'm just a part of an incredibly bigger whole, and I'm just like a flea on the bum of an elephant in many ways, which I find incredibly satisfying, and doesn't mean I don't get upset about the things that don't work, but a passion to live life and this gift we've been given, because you know, nothing makes you appreciate life more than nearly losing it. And to explore and be committed and go to the edge and put your head in the trough of life and suck it up. It's an amazing privilege. A friend of mine said we're spiritual beings having a human experience. So a commitment to just plow into that as much as I could.
Let's talk about your craft, about storytelling. Why is it, do you think, that stories are so central to religious tradition?
It is the shortest way between a human being and the truth. I mean, Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, they're amazing storytellers. I mean, I suppose that's the thing that sort of worried me when I used to go to some of the church services is, you know, Jesus preached in parables and stories, yet we got theological dissertations. And stories, that's what I tell, that's what I am, a storyteller. And I perfected my craft in telling them. I still don't know why they work, though. They just do. I think we're wired for them.
Oh, rats, because that was going to be my next question.
Well, Steven Pinker says as much, I think, in The Language Instinct.
They're almost like a technology for empathy, aren't they? For morality, perhaps, for wisdom.
Yeah, and for truth. You tell a story, and a whole lot of behaviours that wouldn't be excused without the story suddenly make sense. And I know that in developing my craft, if I introduce this aspect about a character before we know them and care about them, it's just going to go flat. It's not going to fly. We have to care. We have to introduce our characters and, you know, show what they're about.
Has telling other people's stories caused you to reflect on your own?
All storytellers tell their own story, whether they're telling it through someone else or not. And if I look at my career of 30 years in television, there's a common theme, and it is, who cares about the caregivers? Who cares for the people that are distributing the care? And that's been my theme through most of my filmmaking, even when I was working on 60 Minutes. You pick the people who were hidden. Like we did one on Compass earlier this year called Widows of War. I mean, we all talk about the diggers dying, but what about the ones who they were married to?
Why are you interested in that, do you think?
Oh, probably some deep psychological overlooking of me as a kid that I was trying, dropped in my head out of the pram.
Wouldn't it be that you were taking care of the kid who was dropped out of the pram?
That's probably right. Yeah, somebody looked to watch over me. Somebody to be seen. I think, you know, it's probably, you know, admit it, is to be seen and to be known. And I think that's what I got on the mountain, to be known to your core for who you were and accepted and loved regardless. And so I think by doing that in my storytelling, I'm sort of somehow doing the same thing. It's a huge compliment when you turn up with a crew worth, you know, a few grand a day to put this person's story on air where a million people will see it. I mean, that's a wonderful endorsement of your worth as a human being. And, you know, I don't take that lightly. We choose our stories carefully because we think people will be interested in them.
Paul Hawker, thank you very much for joining me on The Good Life.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Paul Hawker, series producer on ABC Television's Compass program, talking about storytelling and the good life.